refuses to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
As always, I am grateful to the people who support my work by subscribing to this program. Dave Radcliffe just upped for, he re-upped for another year. Thank you, David. Also, Sean Smith, Michelle Pasco in Sacramento, and Jeffrey Zeiser just north of Chicago. Each and every one of you, I appreciate your support. And today we're going to go in-depth and take a critical look at the electronic media in these United States. My guest today, Professor Robert W. McChesney. He's a media man. Professor McChesney's brand new book is called Digital Disconnect, subtitled How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. And he applies critical thinking to a lot of things that we take for granted now. The conversion of our computers into digital appliances, the arrival of the so-called walled gardens like Facebook and other online communities. And I think it is a very important book, and I encourage you to find it and read it, because it doesn't have a happy ending. And I think people need to be prepared, as capitalism has overtaken the early ideas of an internet that was going to be the great media equalizer. And Bob McChesney, I really appreciate what you have done in this new book.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
And Robert W. McChesney is the Guts Gell Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of numerous books and has collaborated with our friend John Nichols on books and, of course, on the media advocacy and reform group called Free Press, which we'll touch on in a moment. But, Bob, I wanted to begin by the very disappointing news from the Obama White House about the cabinet appointments for the second term. And while many people have focused on the billionaire Penny Pritzker's appointment as the Secretary of Commerce, I am deeply troubled by his selection of Tom Wheeler to head the Federal Communications Commission. And Tom Wheeler has so many conflicts of interest. They're very well detailed in a commentary piece at Counterpunch that I will link to in the show file with this podcast, written by B. Blake Levitt. And he gives 12 reasons why Tom Wheeler should not be confirmed as the chair of the FCC. Before I delve into any of those arguments, what is your take, Bob?
Well, I've read the piece you're talking about, and I agree with the piece. It's a very sobering moment, I think, for someone like myself and for people who have been active in media reform politics for the last decade or 15 years, that we really, you know, see that when we have the president of the United States, a Democrat, elected, I think, with fairly strong support from the media reform communities, particularly in 2008,
yes,
when he ran on a very progressive platform for communication policy. To see him actually turn around and appoint someone who's a corporate executive, a lobbyist for huge industries that live off of government monopoly licenses, and a bundler, a fundraiser for candidates, a very successful one. To see that sort of person get put in charge of the FCC, it's really an astonishingly depressing development. I think your response is correct. And I think it's one that those of us in the media reform community have to really take stock of, because to me it suggests that it might be time for a change in direction for our whole movement.
Interesting. You want to elaborate for a moment?
I'd be glad to. And I'm speaking here as, not as an insider who's in the middle of the room as policies being laid out by any of the media reform groups. I helped form Free Press, as you know, and I'm on the board. I was president until 2008, and I'm still on the board. But I'm completely supportive of the group and the movement, but I play no role in sort of devising policy in a day-to-day thing. My normal life is as a college professor and as a writer and doing shows like this one. But when we started Free Press, the whole idea behind it, and I think it's the whole idea behind the modern media reform movement that began 10 or 12 years ago, 15 years ago, is that the range of debate in Washington was too narrow. Basically, it was big corporations behind closed doors duking out for the largest slice of the cake, but no one else got to be at the debates. No one else got a slice of the cake. All the fights were intercorporate. And we thought the whole point of the media reform movement was that these fundamental policy decisions that were being made that were shaping the internet, our news media, our culture, that affect our lives dramatically, that these should be made in the public interest with our informed consent. We should be at the table. Mm-hmm. And the idea of Free Press and this movement was that we would organize hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people from around the country and demand that the range of debate in Washington be expanded beyond just debates over whether AT&T or Verizon gets a better deal. And that was the point of the group. And I think that this meant we had one foot inside Washington, one foot fighting on the ownership rules and the various fights on Congress and in Capitol and in the FCC. Mm-hmm. And we also have one foot, a bigger foot, outside of Washington, organizing people who are deeply concerned with media to really strike out boldly with broad new ways of thinking about media policy to really dramatically change and improve our system and raise issues that no one inside Washington would consider thinkable, but people outside of Washington thought made perfect sense. The sort of issues I'm talking about, the getting rid of political advertising for candidates. To most Americans, a brilliant idea. Inside the Beltline, you can't even mention that without fear of losing your job. Another idea, outside the Beltline, everyone loves the idea of stopping the obscene commercial degradation of childhood by bombarding kids with ads from birth. Outside of the Beltline, no one likes that, wants to get rid of it. Inside the Beltline, you can't touch that issue because the lobbies are too strong. Outside the Beltline, people love the idea of there being lots of local media, lots of owners, lots of competition. Inside the Beltway, you can't touch that issue because the lobbies are too strong. So I thought the whole idea was, the movement was we were going to go outside the Beltway, get people, really capture their imagination, and go in en masse and force the people inside the Beltway to start taking, expand the range of what the debate was on and introduce the public. So that was the idea. And, I think what happened to our movement was we had much more success initially than anyone thought possible, certainly than I thought possible, going back 10 years ago when we were able to stop Bush's efforts to relax, if not eliminate, media ownership rules in 2003. And then we won a couple more victories to protect network neutrality, to stop government propaganda with fake news.
Yeah.
And I think what happened was we were so successful as a movement that we got involved in thinking that we could be sort of players with the Democrats and liberals and progressives. And once they got power, we could start winning major victories on our issues. And I think what we discovered is that even though they talk a great game out of power, the Democrats, when they're in power, their spine shrivels to jelly. And they basically become susceptible to the same corporate logic, which is corporations on the board and of both parties. And we didn't get hardly anything. In fact, I think you could argue that the Obama administration's FCC for the last 4.5 years hasn't been appreciably superior to that of the Bush administration, the final 4 years under Kevin Martin.
Yeah.
It's really been a succession of defeats, and this is a long way of saying that the Tom Wheeler appointment was really President Obama and his administration lifting the middle finger to the activists in this country, saying, we don't care about you, we don't need you, you're not a factor, you're going to vote for us anyway because the other choice are Republicans, so we can totally sell out and get away with it. You have no choice. And I think that leaves the public interest groups in Washington in a very difficult spot, many of them, to a certain extent Free Press, but not as much Free Press, but many of them embrace Tom Wheeler because they know they've got to work with Democrats. It's their only hope. And if they can't piss off Democrats, or Tom Wheeler and his staff won't return their calls. So they stand up and cheer and say, oh boy, Tom Wheeler's a great guy. Because if you're going to stay in Washington, that's what you do. And I think it points again to the need that our movement maybe needs to get outside of Washington. We've seen how far we've gotten in Washington, and it's not very far until we go out and really get the countryside aroused again and get them motivated and come in with a far more radical set of demands that have popular support and really threaten to raise serious hell. Until we get to that point, we're just going to be cheerleading various corporate candidates, and the actual amount of positive things that will get done is going to be very small, and it'll be so small that it won't capture the attention or enthusiasm of anyone outside the Beltway or outside these industries.
Very well put, Bob, and I'm glad that you are rethinking strategies, and that suggests that there are ways to try to move media reform forward. But I also hear the middle finger message that Obama is sending by appointing Tom Wheeler.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, he was a longtime leader of the cable television industry, served as their lobbyist, and he has been equally active in the wireless telephone industry. And these are two of the key components, the real growth areas, of the regulatory mission of the Federal Communications Commission. And here in San Francisco, we are well aware, because our former mayor, Gavin Newsom, who's now the state lieutenant governor, tried to pass an ordinance, a piece of legislation that simply required cell phone companies to include a label or a disclaimer with a new cell phone that warns that there could be adverse impacts from radiation from the wireless part of your pocketed phone, and that's a kind of disclosure that people should know about. Well, Tom Wheeler led the charge to use San Francisco as an example, and has put the Board of Supervisors in the awkward position now of having to accept a crammed down settlement or pay up about $500,000 in legal fees. In either case, it's a lose-lose, and so the supervisors are backing off, and it is a real victory for the wireless telephone industry, which is operating like the tobacco industry when it comes to any suggestion that these devices could be dangerous. And that's just one example of what Blake Leavitt refers to as the bully aspect of Tom Wheeler. So not only is he deeply conflicted with his financial interests, he runs a $350 million venture capital firm that operates in the FCC regulatory space, but he is a very heavy-handed operator who has successfully represented his clients in the past. And in every case, the public interest is the loser when Tom Wheeler is on the other side of the table.
Oh, you're just getting me going here, Peter. The two industries that you've talked about, the wireless telephone, the cell phone industry on one hand, and the cable television is the other hand, are two industries that are government-created monopolies. There's not a free market bone in any of those bodies. Those industries exist for one reason and one reason alone. The largest firms get government monopoly licenses to franchises or electromagnetic spectrum that gives them monopoly power. So it means a chimpanzee who owns Verizon can become a gazillionaire, because there's only really two cell phone companies that have 60% of the market. And no matter who's running it, you're going to clean up because there's no competition. By the way, the government set up the market, not free market economics. And the same thing's true with cable, where, you know, basically if you want to get cable broadband access in this country with a wire, you have one choice because there's only one cable company in any given town. So there's no competition to speak of. We have a cartel between the cable companies and the cell phone companies to divide up internet access. And as a result of that, we pay far more than people do pay in any other country, comparable country in the world, for a much worse service. It's just astonishing how much we're ripped off. And Tom Wheeler's in the middle of both these industries, greasing his palms and that of these corporate welfare bums who clean up, basically, because they own the government. And this is the guy who's supposed to be representing the public interest now at the FCC. It is, as you put it, preposterous. It's insulting. And it is really the poster child of everything wrong right now with both the Democratic Party and our governing system.
Mm-hmm. Bob, just to put some numbers on it, I finished your book last night, and we pay about five times more on average for cellular service. And we rank, what, about 26th in terms of the speed of the networks in the United States?
Yeah, we have like a horse and buggy system compared to other countries, and we're paying, you know, first class, business class rates. It's an outrage, and it's all due to the fact of the corruption of the policymaking system. There's nothing to do with anything else. These companies have divvied up the market. It's a cartel now between Comcast, Verizon, AT&T that dominate it, that has split up wireline broadband and cell phone markets between them. And then there's a few other companies on the fringe like T-Mobile and a couple others, but it's basically those three. And they divided up the market so they can charge spectacularly high prices without any fear of competition. And they don't have any competitive pressure to upgrade their markets, so they can have these really crappy service markets. It's a huge problem we face, and it's all due to the corrupt policymaking. And the one thing I think it's safe to say, looking at Tom Wheeler's resume, he will do absolutely nothing to alter the way policies are made in this country, because he's one of the champions and beneficiaries of that system.
But Bob, you know, I really trust capitalism, and aren't they charging us those high rates to pay for the next generation of faster networks?
Well, that has nothing to do with capitalism. Capitalism is about maximizing profit. And if you can make more money and not have to invest anymore and you can still make the same amount of profit, you're not going to invest. You're just going to take the money and run. That's what capitalism is all about. The only reason firms would invest in the next generation is if they felt they had to do that or they might lose their market. That's what competition in capitalism is supposed to do. But if you can rig the system so you don't have competition, you can still make your profits, hey, you're in the promised land. That's Valhalla. That's Nirvana. That's where you want to be. And that's where these guys are. And they're there because they own the government.
And your book points out that, in fact, there is no plan for a next-generation network currently in the United States. They're just taking the money, giving us these sluggish kind of mid-zone speeds and you know, bells and whistles, and saying, well, you don't have any other choice, so take it or leave it.
And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book that comes out of this is in communities all over the country, people have gotten fed up with this overpriced, crappy service, and they've tried to set up municipally owned community broadband networks so that everyone in the community can have access to a much higher quality network at a lower price. What we've seen is the cartel, AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast, have gone into every single state legislature, much like you were talking about with Gavin Newsom and his relationship with Tom Wheeler. But the cartel has gone into every single state and tried to make it illegal for communities to set up their own, for lack of a better term, public option for internet access, to force people to restrict the market basically to what the cartel is willing to offer to guarantee complete protection against competition. And the good news, and I think there is good news in my book, is that they have not won in all 50 states, because what has happened, and this is true in the South, the West, all over the country, in any state where people get a good community broadband system and can experience it and get higher speeds, higher quality, without having to pay through your teeth, they're not going to let the cartel take it away from them in state capital. So you've got, in Georgia just recently, the effort by AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast to eliminate the right of communities to have their own networks was crushed because people in rural Georgia who had them said, no, we want this. This is a good thing. So we are winning that fight in state after state, but it's a tough fight. And, you know, we're fighting a monster in AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast. We're fighting you know, the biggest monster imaginable, and they never die. You know, when you think you want to fight, they just hire 3,000 more former members of Congress at $1 million a year to go out and lobby.
We're talking with Professor Robert W. McChesney here on the Peter B. Collins Show. His new book is called Digital Disconnect, and as he mentioned, he is one of the co-founders of Free Press, a media reform organization, and he colluded with Josh Silver and John Nichols to help start that organization. Bob, I attended the St. Louis conference and the one in St. Paul a few years back. That was about 2008. I was not able to be in Denver this year. Could you give us a quick recap of the conference, and in particular, from one of your opening remarks about the need for perhaps a new approach to media reform advocacy?
Well, this is the sixth of the media reform conferences going back to 2003. We had one in Boston in 2011. We had one in Minneapolis in 2008. Memphis 2007, St. Louis 2005, and the first one in Madison in 2003. And there were around 2,000 people there from all over the country, and actually a pretty large international contingent, which is sort of an interesting subplot that media activism is really taking off all over the world. The United States, in some respects, is almost a leader, ironically, or maybe not surprisingly, in this, but now everywhere in the world we're seeing groups and movements that are forming. And, you know, the principle of the conference is basically to bring together activists on a whole range of media and cultural issues to get them on up to speed, to collapse what would normally take a year or two into one weekend or 3 or 4 days where they can learn about stuff with really good panels that have people know what they're talking about, make contacts, build networks, build organizing capacity to win victories. And I think the conferences have been, without exception, a smash hit. They accomplish a great deal. But to get to your question about this last conference, I do think that there was, across the board, a general sense that we need to recharge the battery in terms of an identity. What are we fighting for? What do we stand for? And that I think there is a sense that that's sort of we're floundering a little bit. That, you know, it's clear that the strategy of locking the boat onto the wagon of the Democratic Party and Obama, you know, that sort of hasn't worked. And we don't need a movement to do that. If we're just going to cheerlead the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, there's people, plenty of people willing to do that. We don't need to have any organizing to do that. And I think across the board, from Free Press President Craig Aaron's plenary address, his keynote address, to everyone there, there's an understanding that we need to, like, be more grassroots. We've got to really think it through. And I think there's a moment of reflection going on now in the whole movement about how best to accomplish these ends.
And I want to take a moment here to talk about the regulatory structure. And just for your own information, Bob, I was a radio kid, and my first contact with the FCC was to get an operator's license. My second contact was after I had read the Communications Act of 1934 and some of the other regulatory processes. I filed a license challenge to my local Top 40 station that was my favorite, where I grew up in Cincinnati. I was 14, and I pounded out these letters on a typewriter. I got the commission to designate the license renewal for hearing, and I was as surprised as anybody. But the big surprise was the time I finally had a meeting with the station general manager, and I had to have my mom drop me off. And he was pretty stunned that the guy who'd been writing all these letters and causing such headaches for him was a 14-year-old high school student.
What year was that, Peter, if I may ask?
Well, it was in 1967. And we still had a license renewal process, which required a station owner to show that they had listened to the community, that they had provided service and not just entertainment and commercials. And so it really imbued me with that desire to change the media, and I became what Spiro Agnew called an inside agitator. So after I went to Northwestern, I worked in radio in Chicago. And to fast forward to the present, my contact with the FCC is that I am a part owner of a licensed radio station in Monterey, California. And so I've had this you know, interaction with the commission virtually all of my life. And it is so disappointing to see that the language in the law and the operation of the commission are so far apart. And it has only become worse since the 1996 Telecommunications Act. And I recently, I'll tell you in a moment about a conference I went to, but one of the presenters there was a lecturer from University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Christopher Terry. And he recapped the 1996 Telecom Act, particularly as it relates to diversity of viewpoints in the media. And as you know, I'm a progressive who has been on the losing end of the distribution of viewpoints, if you will. I was part of the movement to launch Progressive Talk Radio starting in 2005. That's why we bought the radio station in Monterey. And it has been deeply disappointing to see that we were unable to compete financially with the established right-wing talk juggernaut, and that we certainly didn't have a level playing field in the attempt to do that. But, you know, the commission actually was mandated by the 1996 deregulation to conduct a study about viewpoint diversity and to report back, I think, every 3 or 4 years to the Congress on the impact of deregulation on viewpoint diversity. And to my knowledge, they not only didn't do a baseline study in order to track any changes, good or bad, but they have basically just ignored the law and not even bothered to go through the motions. So that's a long-winded setup, but I'd like you to take a moment or two to talk about the lack of diverse viewpoints in the corporate media in this country and how you view the cost of that to our society and to what passes for a democracy these days.
Well, it's appalling, the range of debate. You know, my friend Jeff Cohen, the founder of Fairness, Accuracy, and Reporting, he puts it well. He says the range of debate in the corporate media extends all the way from GE to GM. And that really gets it. I mean, it's, you know, on issue after issue after issue, the range of debate is basically the range of debate of the elite of this society, which runs both political parties. So on the economy, the concern is invariably with making investors and corporations profitable. Unemployment is just a very limited concern. Unemployed people get in the way of, it's a concern to the extent it affects business negatively, but to the extent it affects, you know, tens of millions of working class Americans negatively, it's not an issue at all. But that's not because Americans don't care about unemployment. It's because it doesn't fall within the range of GE to GM. Foreign policy, another classic case. We Americans have the most stunted, pathetic understanding of what the world actually looks like and the U.S. role in the world, because we have a news media that parrots the range of debate between those in power and Washington, GE to GM. And so the United States is this benign country that's out to do good and protect democracy. And anyone who doesn't accept the U.S. dominance of the world is against democracy and a horrible government, and that's all she wrote. And that's a preposterous way to understand the world. It's simplistic and moronic. And dissident voices, of which there are many wonderful ones, including your own, are nowhere to be found to challenge these sort of shibboleths. So it's a real problem, because you can't have a self-governing society that's effective unless people have a range of informed opinions, there's actual debate, whether the premises of a social order are being debated. And, you know, I don't want to extend this comparison too much, but, if you were to go to the Soviet Union in the 1970s, there was actually debate in Pravda and Izvestia and TASS on certain issues about whether some commissar met his tractor quota or whatever. There was controversy, but you never could debate the dominance of the Communist Party, its hegemony, and its legitimacy. That was off limits. That was not permissible. And I think that's the first thing any democratic person would say, well, that's bogus. If you can't challenge the people who actually run the society, it's not a very free society. And I think we have to take a hard look at our news media and say, if these guys can't challenge the dominant force in society, exactly how free is our media? How equipped are we to really participate in setting up how our country is structured, how our government works, how our economy works? I think it's been a dreadful job. It's one of the reasons I'm involved in media reform, because if we don't have a press system that works, self-government becomes a joke.
Well, and the idea that self-regulation will work, we've seen what a massive failure it's been on Wall Street, and that's basically what the FCC has devolved to. You know, they regulate technical issues, like if one station is using too much power and interfering with another, but they really don't get involved in the real elements that were contained in the 1934 Communications Act, which, to boil it down to one power sentence, is that licensees are required to serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And, you know, that to me is very clear, and yet it has is all been shoved aside in order to generate more profits for an increasingly shrinking network of operators.
Well, the FCC is the classic captured regulatory agency. And what I mean by that is that the only people who really pay attention to the FCC are the corporate media owners who have all these monopoly licenses for radio and TV channels and cable systems and cell phone systems. And they've got a battery of full-time, well-paid people, usually former staffers at the FCC, who hawk everything it does, pay careful attention. And anyone working at the FCC knows that when they leave the SEC, if they've played ball with those guys, they're sitting and looking at a six or seven figure income job. And if they get made race hell with those guys, they're going to have a short career and an unhappy one. They're not going to get support from anyone. So the whole logic of the system goes toward one that is sympathetic to those you're supposed to regulate. And instead of regulating them in the public interest, you see your job as advocating for them against the public interest to protect their profitability and their future. And that maps with probably what's best for your future. There are so many examples, Peter, of what you've talked about. Let me give a recent one that should get everyone's blood boiling. It used to be, until the early 1990s, that the courts, as well as the law, said that the most important measure of the public interest for a broadcaster was its coverage of elections, especially local elections, which is, you know, we really need radio and TV broadcasters to do a good job on all those down-ticket races that don't get a lot of coverage. And this is the most important criteria that should be used at license renewal. Well, you know, our commercial broadcasters have abandoned any pretense of election coverage, any whatsoever. Why cover elections when you can just sell, you know, 1,000 ads a day with that toxic propaganda and make a fortune and not do any journalism? So we don't get any coverage. But the FCC ignores that, as you pointed out, completely. They couldn't care less about that. They would no more think that's an issue than they would think that we should all move to Mars and set up shop there.
And Bob, let me amplify that point, because in addition to what I do with this podcast, I run a business and I work as a media consultant on political campaigns. And so I have spent actually millions of dollars of campaign cash, not on misleading ads. I actually do good ones. But last year, I worked for a progressive woman who was running for the open congressional seat here on the North Coast in California. Out of 53 or 55 House seats in California, it was the only open seat. And we are in the coverage area of the San Francisco television stations. And it was a contested race. There were four viable candidates out of a field of 12. And the TV trucks from San Francisco never showed up. They did not lift a finger to cover the race. And from what we know, it was never even mentioned in what's called an anchor read, you know, when the person with great hair and doctored features reads a story and they put a picture up in the background. So they provided actually zero coverage of the only open seat race under the you know, new district lines here in California. And so, and also, I'll just add this, that Dianne Feinstein, our nominally Democratic senior senator, coasted to re-election against an unknown Republican opponent. And they didn't even bother to kind of recap what she had done or failed to do in the preceding 6 years. It was just, oh, well, there's no money up against her. She's going to win. There's no news there. We don't need to tell the public what her record is so that they can decide whether they want to reelect her or not. It really is shameful.
You know, my forthcoming book, which we don't want to tout too much today, with John Nichols, called Dollarocracy, we go into this very issue in great detail. But let me add this one point, because this is something that gets to the issue about FCC and its complete bankruptcy as a regulatory agency. The commercial broadcasters, including the company you own, Peter, you are responsible for the ads you put on the air. You can't run quack ads and get away with it. You've got to make sure that you think you're running credible ads.
Mm-hmm.
Now that ruling does not apply to political advertisements. They don't want you investigating the quality of a candidate's ads. That they're protected by the First Amendment from your sort of monitoring them as a commercial broadcaster. But one of the interesting things that took place since Citizens United, especially, is that the vast majority of TV ads, or the majority now, are not done by candidates, but they're done by independent third-party groups. These sort of super PACs, they're called. Oftentimes, they're anonymous groups, so the funding is unknown, it's anonymous, it's channeled through the Cayman Islands. And the vast majority of the ads that these secretive groups do are negative ads. They're attack ads. Almost all of them, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by law, commercial broadcasters that air these ads should be held accountable for their veracity. These are not candidate ads protected by the First Amendment. These are third-party ads. They should be held to the same veracity a toothpaste ad or a used car salesman ad would have to be held to. And they don't do any of it, none of it. There's not a single instance of a single one of these moronic, toxic, propaganda negative ads ever being not aired because it didn't meet sort of evidentiary standards of honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And the FCC took not a step anywhere to touch that issue. They basically looked the other way while commercial broadcasters all across this country raked in $6 billion last year airing this garbage and did nothing to check the veracity of these ads, which they're required to by law. I mean, that's just a recent example of what you're talking about.
Our guest is Robert W. McChesney. His new book is Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Bob, I recently attended a conference put on by the University of Oregon called What is Radio? That's where I met Christopher Terry, who I cited a few minutes ago. But one of the things that really struck me is that three different presenters at this academic conference cited your work, and in particular, your concept of political economy of communication, shortened to PEC. Take a moment to define that for our listeners as we dive into your important new book.
Well, I don't want to get too much into the weeds here of academia. I would say that when we talk about political economy of communication, it's an understanding that our communication systems, both telephone, internet, and also radio, television, press, film, broadcasting, all the forms of communication, both interpersonal and mass, that we have, and they're increasingly one and the same in the form of a smartphone or a computer, that these systems are not ever the function of a free market. They're not ever sort of out of Adam Smith's playbook. All of them, without exception, are the result of massive government subsidies and or policies, usually both, monopoly licenses. And so how those policies are made, how they're determined, are going to go a long way towards shaping what sort of press system, what sort of media system, what sort of communication system we have, who's going to be favored in society, what values are going to be favored, which values are not going to be favored. And now as we see the significant role communication plays in our politics, in our economy, in our culture, it is our culture, that those sort of decisions, so the type of system we have, the type of values we favor, is really going to determine a lot about our society. So the political economy of communication critically assesses what the policies are, what the values are that are privileged, what the options are that could have been or might still be, and says that's what we should be studying. And once we get to that, sort of the nucleus of the atom, if we get in there and see what our real alternatives are, we can see a way to come up with a very different, in my view, dramatically superior society than the one we currently have.
And I don't think that's weedy or weedsy at all. And I think that we need to apply critical thinking to the evolution of the media, which a lot of people have really not paid much attention to. And the shift, of course, from print journalism and the hordes of reporters who've been laid off in the last 10 years, the reduction in the amount of enterprise reporting, all of these play into the shift and the dumbing down of media, the doping of the American public on the kind of content that is used to pander to them. I like to point out that people yawned about the stolen elections, the presidential elections of 2000 and 2004, but they were absolutely apoplectic when questions came up about the validity of the telephone voting for American Idol. And I just think that epitomizes how passive people are when it comes to these dramatic shifts. Now, take a moment, if you would, to educate us on what happened in the 1990s, because you begin the book by talking about those, the celebrants, the people who were deep believers and kind of had a messianic view of what the internet could be. And one of them whom you mention is Stuart Brand. And I'll just say that the first time anybody showed me the World Wide Web was when a friend took me to Stuart Brand's office in Sausalito and said, "Hey, take a look at this." And I was alive. It was so exciting to consider what could be. And now, 15 or so years later, we have a very different world that shows up on our computer screens.
Well, you know, I think what I try to talk about in the book, and I'm the same age you are, Peter, so I've been through the whole thing from before the beginning. And, you know, when the internet came along, and I knew people as early as the 70s who were working on predecessors to the internet, but throughout the 80s and into the early 90s, the crucial thing I tried to make clear in my book is that the internet was a testament to socialism. It was a purely public sector creation. The private sector got some contracts, but not many, to do it. But you know, in 1972, the government actually offered the internet, the predecessor to the internet, to AT&T and said, "Do you want to take this thing over?" And AT&T studied it and said, "No, we can't figure out how to make money on it. You keep it." And it only exists because of massive government subsidies that created it in that period. And it was created by and large by a coterie of computer scientists at major research universities like Illinois, where I teach, Michigan, MIT, Caltech, and a few others, Berkeley, that were hippies. They were counterculture people. As Mark Andreessen put it, the founder of Netscape and now a big Silicon Valley investor, gazillionaire dude, he said in the early 90s, when they were doing Netscape, the internet was basically a militantly egalitarian and cooperative environment. The idea that someone would do anything commercial on the internet was unthinkable. In fact, it was illegal until the early 90s to do anything commercial on the internet. It was regarded as the genius of the internet, the beauty of it, it was going to be a sanctuary, a refuge to get away from all the crap of the corporate culture. This is one place where they couldn't get in. This was belonging to everyone. We were all equals. And it wasn't for selling crap. It wasn't for trying to shake people down. It was going to be basically everyone is an equal in a non-commercial, egalitarian environment working together, cooperative. And that was what drove the internet. And still a lot of the celebrants today, that they still exist, that they're evoking that vision, that sense of where we're going. And they claim we're still going to get there. We're just taking a detour through Google, eBay, Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, and these other monopolies. The detour, in my view, is going to take, you know, the current rate, several centuries before we get back to what they were talking about. I don't think it's on the horizon. But, you know, that was what we saw in the early 90s. The advertising community was convinced in the early 90s, as they put it, everyone connected to the internet has a deep hostility to anything to do with advertising. They will not allow it online. So I'd ask the question is, why was it by the end of the 90s that was completely gone? Why was it by the end of the 90s the idea that whoever makes the most money should win was the reigning operating logic of the internet, of the World Wide Web? And I think the short answer to that is that the infinite nature of the internet, that everyone could start their own website and you didn't have to worry about being crowded out, made it such that people let their guard down, that the same people who were the celebrants, who were the utopians, who had the scientists who did all the work to create these networks, said, well, we don't really have to worry about what advertising agencies and Rupert Murdoch and all these corporations are doing, because whatever they do, we can still do our thing. They can't stop us. There's room for all of us, and we can still win. And if they try to screw with us, we can always go in and hack them and stuff, and so that'll keep them away from us. All we need to do in that logic was keep the government away. The government didn't censor websites, which I think is a good thing to prevent. Everything, the outcome will be positive. And I think that was a really naive view of how capitalism works, of technology. And we see the result of it, that we have now turned the internet on its head in many respects. And Peter, the issue I think that demonstrates this most thoroughly is with advertising. You know, advertising, back in the 90s, no one could figure out how you could do advertising online. I mean, because no one was going to be dumb enough to sit through an ad if they could avoid it. That was why you went to the internet, so you wouldn't have to watch ads and suffer through them. And the advertising community was deeply concerned about the fact that they might not have a reason to exist. If they could only do ads to people who wanted to voluntarily watch them, well, gosh, that's no fun.
Well, and let me just frame it a little more as well. This came at a time when DVRs like TiVo were allowing television viewers to skip through commercials and diluting the impact of corporate advertising. And also the audience started to shift. Where people go to the web now for video services. Most of the people I know under the age of 30 don't watch a traditional television, even a fancy flat screen. They prefer to watch snippets of The Daily Show on a phone or a laptop. And so, you know, these things had left the traditional funders of media flat-footed. And so there was a scramble in the early aughts as they tried to figure this out. And as you point out in the book, one of the critical shifts was the collection of user data, the use of cookies, the cookies that land on my computer that are reporting on me constantly. I don't even know that they're operating in the background. I don't even know who's got a cookie on my computer. And if they know that I went to a gambling site or a porn site or spent 15 hours watching stupid videos at YouTube. But the tracking of our internet usage is what has really enabled the corporate sector to build its new type of control over the internet.
That's right. And back in the 1990s, you know, the great thing about the internet was you could be anonymous on it. You could go on there and no one know who you are. You could create a fake identity even if you wanted to. What you did was completely your own business. You could anonymously go to different websites and see what other people are seeing. And this drove advertisers nuts. They didn't know, how can we possibly cash in this environment? And the irony is it's been turned on its head. Today, basically, the starting assumption any sane person should have is everything you do online is known by both government, national security agencies, and all sorts of commercial interests pretty much have a profile of you, of everything you do and what sort of person you are. You have anything you do online, you should expect they have access to, including your emails, the works. So how did we get to that point? Well, a couple of things happened. First of all, starting in the mid-90s and accelerated since then, cookies and other techniques were installed so basically they could take profiles of you off your computer. They could plant these cookies, and now there are scores of firms that track people, collect data, and use it then to sell it to people who want to advertise and market. And that means that you've basically lost that whole thing about being anonymous. That's gone. It also means another thing, which is we're just starting to see now, which is that content online is then tailored specifically for individuals. So, you know, if you do a Google search and I do a Google search for something, we're going to get different results now based on our history with Google. Google will anticipate what we're interested in looking at. If we go to different major websites, you and I might get different pages coming up based on what they think we'll want.
Well,
based on our
Well, we definitely will. And Bob, when I do live call-in radio shows, I work occasionally at KGO here in San Francisco. I've done this on several occasions where I'll say, call in with your computer on, and I'll instruct them, let's all load Yahoo or, you know, a page like that. and then ask people to report what ads they're seeing. And there are some ads that appear to be placed across the board, and many others are very carefully tailored to the presumed user of that computer. And people are shocked when they see it, you know, really vividly laid out in front of them that way.
You're absolutely right. And this is the great revolution in advertising that's taking place online that people aren't really aware of yet. It has unbelievable consequences for our society. And the revolution is that the whole trend now is what's called smart advertising. So if a firm goes online, it doesn't go to an ESPN website or CNN website or New York Times website, say, I want to buy some ads because I know you get interesting traffic at your website. Here's $1 million to buy a bunch of ads in your website, and then you take some of the money and hire reporters to put more content on to keep people coming to your website. It doesn't work that way anymore. And it won't work that way at all in the near future. We're in a transition period. Instead of smart advertising, Procter & Gamble, General Motors, goes to a network run by Google or Facebook or Microsoft or Yahoo and says, I want to reach, you know, 18 million women who might be in the market for my product in the next 6 months, who are college educated or live in this area, and find them online in the next day and hit them with a message wherever they are. And they will find those 18 million women, whatever website they go to. There's a very good chance it won't even be a media website. It could be the Best Buy website or the Target website. And the network will keep most of the money for the ad. And the websites where they track down women, and it'll only go to the women at that website who are in the target audience, no one else, will only get a 2% or 3% of the buy instead of 100% that would go to in the old days would have gone to the media. So there's not money there for content. That's one of the reasons why journalism is dead. Commercial journalism is dead and gone in the United States and soon worldwide. Soon there just won't be resources to pay for reporters and editors at all. And we've already lost over half of our resources to journalism in the last 25 years on a per capita basis. And smart advertising is the final nail in the coffin for commercial media, for journalism specifically.
And I'll just add that you correctly note in your book that journalism was in decline before the internet arrived, but it certainly has accelerated. Now, let's turn to what my Facebook friend Bob Levin refers to as Fedbook, and talk about, first of all, the walled garden concept and how people are spending now, 20% or more of their time online at Facebook. And we are self-reporting our activities. We're posting photographs that we lose control of once we do post them. And we're basically voluntarily giving up so much of our privacy. And it's one thing for the people at Facebook to be able to use that to then slot ads on the right-hand side of my page or right in the middle of my mobile stream if they're, you know, that they think are going to fit what they have deciphered are my sensibilities. But let me put it to you this way, Bob. What do you fear more, that Facebook knows all about me or that Facebook can be used by the government to find out everything about me?
Well, I fear them both equally, and I don't mean that to sort of dodge the question, but I think we should not see them as adversarial relationship. The great crisis is rather that they are best friends. And let me explain what I mean. When the internet began in the 1990s, probably the biggest claim for it was that it would blow up capitalism as we know it. It would give new entrepreneurs the ability to reach markets, to get information, to challenge the existing dinosaur companies. So there'd be 100 new car companies that could better serve consumers, and you wouldn't have to get a clodhopper car from General Motors or Chrysler. And this would be true in every industry. And it would give consumers all sorts of power to go out and get lower prices and higher quality online. And so it would be just a golden age to be a consumer. Great competitive capitalism, you know, business at the speed of thought, or whatever Bill Gates called it. And instead, what we've seen with the internet is that instead of being an engine of competition, it has become the greatest engine of monopoly in the history of the human race. Everywhere it turns, sort of like, you know, the Midas touch of monopoly, every industry touches becomes a monopoly. And so we have in the United States today, 13 of the 30 most valuable firms in terms of market value are all internet companies, 13 out of 30, and they're all monopolies. They all have the source of their gusher profits that they build their empires with is some sort of monopoly franchise online. Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, Qualcomm, you go right down the list. They all have a monopoly franchise And largely this is due to what are called network effects, meaning the largest company in a network, everyone automatically goes to it because there's such great advantages and no one else can really compete. And part of it's due to government policies, which have made this easier to do without consequence. But what we have are all these monopolies, these huge monopolies that completely dominate the internet. Like never before we had anything like this. And this is a very frightening thing for democratic theory. And democratic theory, and this is even Milton Friedman. If you were to read Milton Friedman's book on capitalism and how great it is, Capitalism and Freedom, his argument for why capitalism's the freest type of society is that it separates economic power from political power. Unlike feudalism or communism, the same person who runs the economy doesn't run the government. And secondly, economic power is highly competitive, meaning that people can rise up to the top. It's not entrenched like feudalism, where you're born into a station and you die into a station. And that's what protects human freedom, Friedman said. That's why capitalism is the only truly democratic economy. And I don't agree with Friedman, but I think there's a lot of logic to his argument. And I think we should take it seriously. Well, you look at what's happened to capitalism now in the digital age. Well, we have nothing close to competition. We have these massive giant firms that are monopolies that completely dominate the digital economy and dominate the whole economy. I just named them. And we also have, instead of an adversarial relationship between them and the government, they are one and the same with the government. AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, Google, they're not in some sort of adversarial relationship with the government. They own the government. They are the government. They control the government. So we have really Milton Friedman's nightmare. We have massive unaccountable monopolies in bed with the government, working hand in hand. And I don't mean to be pejorative about this, Peter, but you know that is the classic definition of fascism, one of them.
Oh, we're not afraid. We're not afraid of the F word here, Bob.
Okay, it's the marriage of monopoly corporate power with a government, and it means the government is obsessed with propaganda, secrecy, militarism, and helping corporations make money, and the corporations help the government do its job, and they scratch each other's back. I think that is a more accurate way to understand what's going on in the United States today than is Milton Friedman's pipe dream.
Yeah,
I think we have in the United States today, the real world of capitalism is one where the government is working very closely with these giants and they take care of each other's interests. And I think this gets back to your friend's concern about FedBook or whatever.
That's what he calls it. Yeah. He's a retired FBI agent.
Yeah. I think we're in a situation now that is absolutely unprecedented in terms of civil liberties attacks, and where there's sort of a commonality of interest between these large corporations that have access to information and the government, and there's very little accountability for them. And I document it in the book, as you know. I mean, it's just astonishing what they can do, and no one knows, not even Congress.
One thing that I discovered through a purloined memo that was published in a website kind of like WikiLeaks is that Facebook actually generates revenue from servicing warrants and other requests for information about their users. And I say warrants and other because the national security letters used by the FBI are not really warrants. A judge doesn't approve them. And there are also more informal requests that are placed by law enforcement to look at the page of a Facebook user. And I'm not aware of any cases where Facebook has rejected those requests. And they have a standard setup where the law enforcement agencies pay a fee to Facebook for the privilege of violating the privacy of a user. And it's remarkable. It's not a secret, but it's not widely known. And that's just one example of the kind of collusion that you described.
Oh, and it's not just Facebook. It's Google. It's Microsoft. I mean, the phone companies, AT&T and Verizon, you know, they've got huge wings of their companies that do nothing but service secret, unaccountable government demands for information on users to the network. So it's just built into the system right now. There's very little pressure, countervailing pressure to stop it. And there's tremendous momentum and lots of jobs and lots of money to keep it going. It is a great crisis of our times. It's one I write about in the book, and it's one in which the Obama administration has not been a progressive force. I mean, it's a case where both political parties are on the wrong side here. The American people who care about their freedoms, really don't have a dog in the race in Washington.
Bob, I want to turn to another fascinating item that is in your book, Digital Disconnect, and that is the idea of citizenship news vouchers, a way to use taxpayer dollars that are directed by the individual taxpayer to support independent media. And you can imagine that somebody like me has more than a passing interest.
Yeah, and you know, this is an idea that initially the great economist Dean Baker came up with, and I always want people to understand that Dean had this idea over a decade ago, I think even in the 90s. He's looked at the internet and said, you know, this poses fundamental problems for having a credible news media system or cultural system once everyone can get everything for free online instantly. And, you know, I think the starting point to understand the idea of the citizenship news voucher, Peter, is that journalism specifically, leave aside entertainment and culture for now. Let's just talk about journalism, but you can apply it elsewhere. But for journalism, it's a public good. It's something that the society desperately needs. You can't have democracy without it, but that the market cannot provide in sufficient quality or quantity. End users, readers, viewers have never provided sufficient funds to make it a credible market to have a popular journalism. For the first 100 years of American history, we had massive postal and printing subsidies that bankrolled our journalism. And John Nichols and I wrote about this at length in The Death and Life of American Journalism. Mm-hmm. And I go through that again in Digital Disconnect as well. For the last 125 years, advertising has provided between 15 and 100% of the revenues for all news media, depending upon the medium. And it gave the illusion that news media could be something that was very lucrative and profitable, but it was only because of advertising, which had a purely opportunistic relationship to journalism. And as soon as advertising had better alternatives, as they do now with smart advertising, they jumped ship. And as a result, journalism, we can see its public good nature striking us in the face. It's dying short of some sort of public intervention like we had with the postal subsidies under Ben Franklin, Washington, Jefferson, and Madison in the first century of American history. And so that's the logic. We say we need to have a large government subsidy of journalism or we're not going to have it. But we don't want the government to control who gets the money. I think that is a principle everyone agrees with. So how do we do that? And that's where the citizenship news voucher came in, Dean Baker's idea that I've embellished, which is simply every American should be allowed to give $200 of government money to any medium of their choice, as long as it's a nonprofit, non-commercial medium. It doesn't take advertising, and it meets the nonprofit criteria of the IRS, which are very strict, and they've been around for years, so they're well-known and well-worn. And anything that's produced by a group that gets this money automatically goes for free online and enters the public domain. It won't be protected by copyright. And by having that provision, it pretty much restricts it to journalism because most entertainment media requires copyright to have any sort of shelf life. And the idea then would be, if let's say, Peter, you're living in Marin County or San Rafael. Is that Marin?
Yes, and we just got bombed by the New York Times Magazine over the weekend.
Oh, I saw the headline. I didn't read the story. But at any rate, let's say you got 2,000 people in your area were dissatisfied with the news media coverage in your community, mm-hmm. and each of them gave their $200 voucher. Well, that's $400,000 suddenly that you've got out of those 2,000 people. $400,000 can buy you a nice little newsroom for a community like San Rafael. Mm-hmm. And if you do a really good job, you might get a couple thousand people more the next year to give you their vouchers. And if you do a bad job, you won't get the vouchers and someone else will come. It's very competitive. And so it's a way to get public funding so you can have competing independent newsrooms without commercial pressure to do garbage can journalism, but at the same time not have any government control over who gets the money. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'll say one thing about this. When I went to Washington to meet with heads of the FCC and FTC, Federal Trade Commission, in 2010, John Nichols and I met with they each had set up commissions to study journalism and the future of journalism because they were alarmed by the collapse of it. And they read our book back then, which also talked about the citizenship news vouchers, and they both agreed. They said, this is the solution. This is really the only way we'll ever solve the problem. And they both pretty much said, but we can't ever say that. That's a career ender in Washington. We could never come out for that because the right wing would flame broil our butts, and the liberals won't stand behind us. They're scared to death of their shadow.
And it's sad that people cannot think outside of the current political storms and see what is best for our country and for our people. And let me read a citation here from the final chapter of your book. You say, the crisis of our times is that capitalism undermines democracy. The choice we face is whether to expand democracy or let it continue to shrivel. Expanding it requires confronting really existing capitalism head-on. It is the defining issue of our times, the basis for the critical juncture in which we live. The Internet is in the very middle of this critical juncture. It is central to the movement to build a more democratic society and extend self-government to the economy. Digital technologies make the new economy and self-management of decentralized units far more realistic. With enlightened public investments, the Internet can provide the greatest journalism and public sphere ever imagined. Digital technologies also are a crucial part of political movements to mobilize people effectively for social change. So I agree with you. This is a pretty radical statement, especially given that radicalism is pretty well owned lock, stock, and barrel by the right wing these days. But your summation there, I think, is deadly accurate, Bob.
Well, thank you. And I think that, you know, it sounds radical, but I think most people who read the book, you get to the end, it seems pretty logical. It seems like the fruit that should fall off the tree, it's ripened by the first 200 pages, that's really where we need to go. I would also add this. I'm an optimist, although the book, as you said, can point to a fairly depressing future if we don't do anything. My sense is that the vast majority of Americans, or a significant percentage of them, are very sympathetic to the positions I lay out in this book. And to the extent Americans learn about these issues so they can participate in them, they tend not to be in favor of letting AT&T and Verizon and Google own everything. They have great concerns about privacy, about spying, about commercialization in childhood. I think we've got the people on our side here. I think the other sides know that, which is why they do everything in their power to shrink down democracy, because this system wouldn't survive a genuine democracy.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you for joining me today, and I want to wholeheartedly recommend your book. And I want to underscore for people that you apply critical thinking. Your book is deeply researched and detailed. In some cases, there are 4 or 5 footnotes per page. But it's a very accessible book. You're an academic. The book does not suffer from the drawbacks of academic writing. And I think that you make a clear case, as you say, in the first couple of hundred pages, to establish the thought that you offer at the end. And so I think that almost anybody who takes the trouble to listen to my podcast will benefit if you take the time to read Digital Disconnect. Robert, would you like to add anything else before we wrap up?
Well, I just want to get the spelling of your name for my will.
I don't do book blurbs, but I'm happy to to offer my opinion when I find something that I think is really important.
Much appreciated. Let's keep the conversation going and talk some more.
All right. And when you and Nichols publish Dollarocracy this fall, I look forward to talking to you both about it.
Absolutely wonderful.
Robert W. McChesney here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening all the way through. This is an important message from Robert McChesney. I hope you'll grab his book.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until